Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is. Oh, it's just not going to work at all. Never accept a dare from Mark Walsh. Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is Leslie Kaminoff, and you may know me as the co-author of the international bestseller, Yoga Anatomy. But I'm also the co-founder of yogaanatomy.net. Now, that's a platform we built 11 years ago where we offer online courses and in-depth anatomy modules that support teachers, teacher trainings, and students all over the world. So that's why we are thrilled to be sponsoring all the incredible sessions here on the Yoga Channel, including my own. And if you feel a connection with the way I teach, I have some great news for you. We are extending scholarships to all members of the Embodiment Conference. And you can find that scholarship info and links to yogaanatomy.net in the description for this presentation and in the show notes. In the meantime, enjoy your body, enjoy your breath, and enjoy your conference. And I'll see you online.
And now handing over to Peter Blackaby with sensing, interpreting, and responding.
Thanks very much, man. Nice to see everybody. Well, I can't see everyone, but nice to talk to everyone. I want to make this session a little bit talky and a little bit practical. So I'll explain a little bit what I'm interested in and why I'm interested in it, and a little bit about the reason I've got here. Many of you will know I trained as an osteopath in the late 80s, early 90s, and was a practitioner of Iyengar yoga. And at the time, you know, those two systems are very structural. They're very based in anatomy. Obviously, osteopathy is, you spend half your life reading detailed books on anatomy. And to some extent, Iyengar is too, in the sense that there's a lot of work in addressing the tissues of our body. Stretching particularly was a big theme, and working muscles and engaging with our, what I'm going to call structure. And what I mean by that, muscles, ligaments, tendons, bones. And for a long time, I was really fascinated by that because it is a fascinating subject. I find anatomy a deeply interesting subject. But over time, it became more apparent to me that you can be the best anatomist in the world and still not really understand how to move. You know, also you could argue that if anatomy helped you understand movement, doctors and surgeons and osteopaths and chiropractors would be brilliant movers, and they aren't always. And so why is that? The other thing that made me think was, you know, how did people like Nijinsky, you know, dancers who, and the great athletes of the past who never studied anatomy, learn to move so well? Of course, the answer is you practice, and you practice movement, and practicing movement is about sensing and perceiving, and it's not really about anatomy. You could also argue, how do all animals and babies learn to move? They don't do it through studying of anatomy. So I started to feel anatomy was a bit of a red herring. That deeply interesting though it is, and I think we should all have a good understanding of our own anatomy, just because being human, we should know a bit about ourselves. But how we navigate the world and how we navigate our bodies in space is absolutely through sensation. And I want to try to clarify that, or rather differentiate a few words here. Sensation being impressions that land on nerve endings. So it might be things like pressure, or light coming into my eyes, or sound in my ears, or a sense of movement, we could call proprioception. So we have all these sensations that land in our nervous system, travel through nerve pathways and arrive in our brain, where they become interpreted. And during that process of interpretation, we could call that act perception. So we have sensation, which ends up in the brain as perception, the interpretation of sensation. You know, that's what I learned as an anatomist. And then as a as a practitioner, you slowly start to realize that sensation isn't always perceived accurately. So, you know, I might hold tension in my shoulders and not be able to perceive it. Or I might have a sensation of in my nerve endings that I interpret incorrectly as something else. A good example of that would be people who have phantom limb pain. You know, you could have a sensation from a limb you haven't got. And then you start to realize that this is slightly trickier than you thought. You know, it's not a simple act of the brain interpreting sensation accurately. The brain interprets sensation in ways it expects to see or feel or notice. So history then becomes an important part of how we interpret sensation. And we tend to interpret sensation in the light of our own history and our own beliefs and understandings about what those sensations mean. So my interest changed from thinking that the problems of bodies or the solution to movement problems or pain or whatever was in the tissues, which is what I learned as an osteopath and as an Iyengar teacher, or what I believed was the answer, to it's more about how we perceive sensation. It's more about perception. How do we start to help ourselves have a more accurate representation of sensations that are landing in us? And that's kind of been my interest over the last 5-6 years. So my yoga teaching has inevitably changed. You know, it's been less about stretching and working out and what I would call exercise, and much more about trying to find ways of helping clarify what we're really feeling. I mean, there's a very traditional perspective on that, which is you have to bring yourself into the moment in a sense to lose your historical belief about perception. So that, of course, is a strong strand of interest in yoga and most reflective practices. You know, how do we notice ourselves in the moment without history colouring sensation, so that our perceptions become more accurate? And I guess that for me is the interest. Now, I can't say I've got all the answers, but I find it an interesting route to explore. And I think the richness in this is that it's an ever-changing world. You know, we change because we're aging. The world is changing because the world changes. And how we meet that world, how comfortably we meet that world, will be influential in the kind of sensations that arise in us. So there is one other aspect to this that I think I'd just like to explain, and then we'll try a few things out. And this is slightly my own spin on something that you may kind of come to realize is instinctive. Sensations land in us from the world, from the environment. We notice them through our nerves. We perceive it. We respond to it with the perceptions that we have about what we feel we've noticed. And if we respond well and appropriately and navigate the world skillfully, then something happens in us that we feel okay. And that feeling of okay or not okay, if we don't navigate it so well, if we bump into stuff, if things become difficult and hard, gives rise to feelings. This is something the neurologist Antonio Damasio talks a lot about in his book, The Feeling of What Happens. And we could call that qualia. Qualia is the emergent property of a complicated nervous system that is dependent on how we navigate the world. Now, the qualia, we could call them emotions, but it's not always emotions. It's more kind of, how would I express it? How you feel in yourself. You know, if you ask someone, how do you feel? They say, I feel okay, I don't feel okay. I feel a bit edgy, I feel a bit this, I feel calm. Those kind of background feelings I'm going to call qualia. And I think the quality of our qualia is dependent on how skillfully we navigate the world. So a nervous system evolved to interact with the environment as accurately as possible. If you were a hunter-gatherer navigating an environment and you didn't navigate it skillfully, you'd probably be out of the gene pool by now. Learning to notice signals from people, from the environment, respond to them well, keeps you safe and keeps you emotionally safe, not just physically safe, but emotionally safe, and helps you feel all right with the world. And that's what I'm interested in. How do we improve the feeling state of people by helping them navigate the world? So that's my kind of opening gambit. Are there any questions, Marianne, that have come up during that I can respond to?
There was one question about, is it not a misunderstanding that yoga is about stretching? And is that as it's moved west?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complex question in the sense that I think you're probably right. I think I sometimes look at the more esoteric literature, and sometimes I'm very confused by it because I didn't live in that period of time. And I'm not quite sure what they mean. So I'm trying to interpret, you know, if you read something like the Hatha Yoga Pradipika or any of the tantric texts, it's full of metaphors for feelings that may have meant something different to what they mean now. And I often am aware of the huge cultural gap that there is between me and living in the southeast of England now and a medieval practitioner in the middle of India, you know, 1,500 years ago, several hundred years ago. But you're right, I think there is a clear strand of old yoga that was about being in the moment, bringing yourself into the moment, introspection rather than just stretching and moving around. But of course, the complication is that my teacher, Iyengar, initially was an Indian teaching yoga in a very, you know, arguably physical way. And I think there was a lot of sorting out that we've been still trying to do about some of these modern yoga teachers actually mean. Were they really just talking about the physical to get us interested and then take us somewhere else? Or were they just interested in the physical themselves and doing a different kind of yoga? You know, modern postural yoga is arguably distinct from some of the older traditions. But I suppose what I've tried to do is to situate myself exactly where I am, you know, in the West, in this, and deal with what human beings notice in their nervous system. Because I think that's something that doesn't matter where you are, who you are, what time you live in, nervous systems and environments have always been there. And I think it's, you know, that navigation of the environment is something we've all had to learn to do. And that's what I've become interested in. How do we in our world now navigate the world? And what are the problems that being a modern person has? What has it brought to us? You know, the lack of movement that we do, the more sedentary lifestyles that we have, the more psychological worries that tend to permeate modern culture as opposed to perhaps the worries of previous times. So adapting it to where I am, that's what I'm interested in. Okay. Any other questions that we need to deal with before we...
There was one about, so yoga in modern times has lost any real connection to the subtle body, so nadis and channels, and the felt sense of this. So yoga is often taught in a superficial way. Does it have a place now? And I think this is you were just talking about the relating this to a modern person, so perhaps that might be an angle.
Yeah, well, I come back to the idea that when someone is describing nadis, chakras, subtle energy, subtle bodies, how would we know they exist? It must be through some kind of perception, that there must be something that they notice in themselves. And we give words, you know, the words then become the structure through which we try and express what we're feeling. And that may change over time, you know, the language may change, but I don't think perception changes. And the more closely we spend time noticing what's happening to us while we practice, the more likely we are to come up with an accurate representation of it. If we bring ourselves into the moment and try not to color it too much by history. And again, I suppose I worry here a little bit about interpreting somebody else's view from, you know, several hundred years ago, and then trying to tell people that, that's what they should feel is not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in helping people notice what they feel. And sometimes you look at the old literature and go, yeah, I can see how that could marry up. But I would be nervous about making too concrete an overlay of those two ideas, because I don't know. I don't know exactly what they meant. I can only know what I feel and notice, and then see if there are correlations. And that's always an interesting thing to do. Okay. So what I suggest we do is a little bit of simple practice and try to understand what I'm on about, really. So I want to start just doing something very simple like this, lying on your back with one leg bent and one leg straight. With your arms down by your side. And we could talk about the way the nervous system arrives. So there'll be sounds from your room, wherever you are in the world. There'll be a light landing on your eyes. You can close your eyes or have them open. But a nervous system fundamentally evolved to keep us safe. So anything that is distracting, anything that's attracting your attention, drawing you away, if you can do something about it, now is the time. So if there's doors to close, phones to switch off, lights to turn up or down, so that you reduce the possibility of external interruption. And then you can start to draw attention a bit closer to home, and you can think about the way your body meets the floor, or rather sense the way your body meets the floor. And if there's any wrinkles in your clothing, if there's anything you need to adjust to make yourself more comfortable, then do that, because that's why you have a nervous system. It's flagging up all these sensations and asking you to respond. So you deal with those things, and then you come a little bit closer to home. You go, how do I meet the floor? I can feel the weight through my head, my shoulders, my pelvis, my leg. And my foot, and my bent leg foot. And then I can ask myself a slightly more subtle question. How does the weight land in that foot? Can I notice? What do I notice about that? Is it more on the inside of the foot or more on the outside of the foot? Or can I adjust my foot to a place where it feels like that whole footprint is well represented to the floor? So what I'm doing now is noticing the sensation arriving from my foot, and I'm adjusting my position of my leg to make that a more effective one where the leg is more supported, one where the muscles in my leg can reduce their activity. Then I might want to just check that to my best of my ability, the long leg, my straight leg is relaxed. I might notice where my foot is pointing. If it's pointing to the ceiling, I'm probably still doing something. If I really relax my leg, the toe tends to relax out. Does there feel space across my shoulders, behind my neck, the back of my waist? Does my body feel comfortable on the floor? And if it doesn't, is there anything I can do to make myself more comfortable? Until I'm left with a comfortable body lying on the floor, one knee bent, and I see how I feel. How does that make me feel? I may check my jaw, my tongue, my eyes, because we hold tension there too. I might want to move my jaw around. Even my tongue,
roll it around in your mouth as if you're just looking for bits of food in your teeth. And then let it rest. See where the breathing arrives in your body. See how you feel. Now, the problem often arrives when we start to do things. When we start to do things, we quite often bring our history into the movement. So we'll do something very simple, and I'm going to suggest that you send your bent leg knee slightly forwards over the midline of your foot. And notice what you feel as a response to that action. If we were all in a room together, I would probably ask you to sort of speak out what you were feeling, but it's not possible here. So I'll suggest that there are two or three things you notice, maybe more than that. As you send your knee forwards, you feel more pressure under the footprint. Now, how that pressure lands on the foot, whether it's more on the inner or the outer foot, will tell you about the direction of your knee, which way it's traveling. So you get information, you get sensation that we notice and we respond to that helps us navigate our body in space. We're doing this all the time from birth to 5 or 6 years of age, learning to interpret sensations and what they mean. We'll feel other things. We'll feel muscles in our legs start to stiffen as you send the knee forwards. They're working. You'll feel probably the weight under your bent leg hip start to lighten as the hip leaves or moves away from the floor. We call all this proprioception. And the whole point about proprioception, if we keep making this movement forwards and then back, forwards and then back, proprioception is the part of our system that helps us know how well we're navigating our body in space. Now, the quality of the movement, as you send your knee forward, as the hip lifts, as the weight shifts across the back of your body from your right hip towards your left shoulder, maybe, depending on how far you're going with the movement, the smoothness of that movement will tell you something about what you're bringing to it. If your body feels like it's being lifted softly, maybe like a sleeping child would feel if you lifted them out of a cot, that kind of slightly floppy feeling. That's the feeling you have in the body, you are probably quite relaxed. If you feel that the left hip starts to come away from the floor as well, that informs you that maybe you're a little bit more, there's more going on in your body than you realize. And that's what we're interested in. What am I doing that I don't know I'm doing? That's what I think a lot of yoga helps us with. And just change legs for a moment. So bend your other leg, straighten the other leg too. So in my case, my left leg is bent, my right leg is long. I want to completely relax the long leg. I want to put myself in Shavasana relaxation, except for my left, my bent leg. And then again, when I start to act through that leg, I'm acting into a relaxed body. And I'm interested in what I notice. Weight through my foot, effort in my leg, sense of movement, shifting weight across the back of my body. I'm interested in the quality of the movement. I'm interested if my breathing changes. And I try to notice if I do odd things like tighten my jaw or grip my toes or something like that that I bring to it. So I sometimes think of these movements as calibration. We're just tuning into ourselves, doing something simple, often starter class, something like this, to help people drop into their bodies, notice what's going on before we move on to anything remotely more complicated. Good. And then after your next one, we'll come into sitting onto your heels. Actually, I'll turn this way around. One of the things that is apparent about history, the way we practice, is over a lifetime, we develop biases or habits or whatever we want to call them, because that's the way our brain works. It's set up to kind of automate movement. So I don't have to think about walking or talking or chewing. And that's very useful. But some biases can become unhelpful. So when I'm sitting on my heels, I will just try this for a moment. Just bring your feet to one side and sit with your feet to one side and just see how that feels. And then bring your feet to the other side and ask yourself the same question. How does that feel? Do they feel the same? It's probably unlikely. Usually we have a bias. One side feels a little bit more comfortable than the other. In the old days, I'd have blamed my tissues. I'd have said, oh, well, no, this muscle's a bit tight and there's clearly a bit too much stretch here. I now think it's probably perception. I'm just not familiar with this. If you've ever done that experiment where you fold your arms and then you try and fold the arms with the other hand on top, how weird that feels, you know, because it's not your habit, it's not your bias. One way feels normal, the other way feels just weird. It's clearly not to do with stiffness or problems of tissues. This is problems of, well, it's not problems, it's about perception, it's about familiarity. So we go from one side to the other side. We notice one side feels more comfortable, maybe the other a little bit more complicated, or quite a bit more complicated, depending on how long our biases have existed. And I'm not even that, but we have biases. But the problem with habits and biases comes if at any point I can't sit in the other way. You know, if this is the only way I sit and then the other way becomes problematic, then my life is constrained. So in the terms of people like Merleau-Ponty, he says we should disturb habits, we should dust them down, we should constantly irritate them a little bit so that we don't always stay with our bias. Because if we do, they sediment, they become solidified in us and then take away choice, and that's not helpful. So it's not that I'm trying to become completely symmetrical in my perception of the world. I don't think that's possible. But I am interested that I'm not so trapped in one way of doing, I can't be another way. The philosopher John Dewey talks about ways of thinking in exactly the same problem. He said, we have habits of thinking, we think like this, we have these kind of thoughts, we engage with the world with this viewpoint or that viewpoint. He said, these are habits of thought. And he's interested in the way we should disturb those too. And I'm all with him there, because yoga isn't just a physical practice, as we know. Now, if you sit on your heels and bring your hands to your mat like this, we could talk about three ways we could be, or I will talk about three possibilities here. We could use one of the problems, and I do think it's a problem that most human beings acquire over a lifetime, is what we might call tension, unacknowledged holding patterns in muscles. And it's always unhelpful. If you don't know you're holding a muscle tight, in the end, it will either restrict movement or it will give you pain. So the way you learn to discharge tension is to find support. No muscle can relax, and this is an absolute truism, no muscle can relax unless it's supported. So if you kind of hold your arm out like that, muscles have to work, but if you support the arm, I can relax it, and the muscles can quieten down. And the structure in our bodies through which we can discharge tension are our bones, skeleton. So when you rest through your arms,
think of the bones in your arms like columns of support through which you can lean. And really try and lean into them, not collapse. You want to keep the elbows just enough activity in there that you can lean through a column of bone. So it's no good if your arms are too bent. You can't lean through a bent column. And you feel your handprints deepen into the floor. Continue to lean. You might feel the muscles in your back relax a little bit. You might feel the weight come a little bit more heavily into your heels. And then try this. Take the weight a little bit off your hands. Don't take the hands off the floor, but just withdraw them from the floor a few percent of weight. Just withdraw them slightly and see if you can notice the sense of contraction of the muscles in your body. You know, the feeling of tightening, of really drawing in that you feel when you don't quite put the full weight into your hands. And then when you go back to leaning, how you feel as the tension in your body dissipate, it relaxes. Do that a couple of times. So you withdraw the hands. You probably feel your sitting bones lift a little bit away from your heels. You feel a kind of tightening of the muscles of your trunk. And then you lean back into your hands. The handprints deepen and the muscles soften. In yoga, we sometimes call this grounding. But I find the term is become almost meaningless because people's, you know, we end up saying something, it becomes a platitude, but it's really there. The other thing we can do is push. So I could do something like this. I could push my body through. That would be something else I could do. So I could push, that's one sensation. And pushing is about moving. I want to get from one place to another. So pushing would do that. But some people, when they bring their hands to the floor, are already pushing. Rather than leaning. So we could discriminate. I could be not grounded. I could have my hands a little bit not really leaning on the floor. And that gives me one kind of sensation. I could be leaning, which relaxes my muscles. That's another kind of sensation. Or I could be pushing, and that gives me another kind of sensation. So I want to discriminate these different kinds of feelings and what they mean. Now, try something else. Let's turn our toes under. I'm sorry that I can't see all of you and know you better, because some of you may have stiff toes and find this difficult. I just apologize. I can't really adjust for that at the moment. So we do the same thing here. We could lean into our hands. We could rest our pelvis into our heels. We could just relax our neck. We could check our breathing is quiet. We could kind of turn the volume down on our muscles as much as possible. And then we could do something. You see, at the moment, I can relax my muscles fairly significantly because I'm leaning through my hands, my knees, and my toes. So I've got 6 points of contact that take my weight. But if I take 2 of those points of contact off the floor, if I lift my knees, say an inch off the floor, like that, so they're now free of the floor, I'll feel the muscles doing the work that my bones were doing. And then I put my knees back down, and I feel the muscles quieten down again. And what I'm interested here is, when I take my knees off the floor, what is the quietest I can become? I know the volume in my muscles has to turn up because now my muscles are doing the support where my knees were doing it. But I want to know that in that transition from supporting myself through my knees to supporting myself more with my muscles, can I do that skillfully that I don't stop my breathing, I don't tighten my neck, I don't start pushing, all those kind of things I want to clarify. So I practice it a few times. Until I'm sure, as I can be, that I've not added more value to the lifting of the knees than I need to. And that requires quite a lot of getting into myself, feeling my shoulders, my trunk, and then back with the knees back to the floor. Once you've navigated that, we could think about this movement. So I could then take my, once I know what to look for, and it's often the inception of a movement or a transition of a movement where we bring our history in. So I want to be very careful when I bring my knees off the floor that I don't bring my history with me. And then what I'm interested in, can I unfold my legs without adding anything to my shoulders? Because I know I can't lift my hips with my shoulders. I can only lift my hips with my legs. So I become interested then in the possibility of being able to navigate that movement without starting to push, stiffen my neck, change my respiration. Can I keep it as simple as possible? Can I do the only thing I intend to do, which is straighten my legs, without changing what I'm doing through my arms? So for me, dog pose is very much about learning how to find support through my skeleton, to navigate the transition from support through my bones to my muscles as skillfully as I can, and not to add push to the movement. Because if I push, I just become unusefully tight all around my shoulders and my neck, which is not something anyone really benefits from. And then come back and just rest a moment in child pose. Give yourself a break. Now, we'll do one other simple thing to try and help us navigate this a bit more. If we lie on our side with our knees and our arms at right angles to our trunk and our head resting on the floor, if possible, I do want your head resting on the floor. If your neck has got a problem and you feel you need some kind of support here, have the minimum support to get you out of trouble. I'm not particularly interested in having a straight line through my neck. Spines are supposed to bend, and this slight side bend you put into your neck with line, this I think is very useful. But again, I want you to just test this out. If you start to lift your head a tiny bit off the floor, it will withdraw it in the same way we did with our hands. You just start to bring the head away from the floor a little bit and see if you feel all the muscles in the side of your waist stiffen. And then rest your head back down and see if you can feel them all relax. And maybe do the same with your side ribs. So if you lift those kind of ribs away from the floor and then lower them, or start to lift them away from the floor and see if you can feel the tightening of the muscles that bring your ribs away from the floor, and then the softening of the muscles as you drop the ribs back down. So the feeling of having your head resting on the floor, having your arm resting, having your leg resting, having your ribs resting, is what quietens the muscles. And that's really the significant thing. And then we have a movement. We might want to move. We might want to take the shoulder and the arm forward. And then we might want to take it back. You know, this kind of a movement. So it's a fairly straightforward movement, turning movement. And we can go backwards and forwards with this movement of the shoulder and the arm going forwards and back. And what's happening here, of course, all the shoulder girdle, the rib cage, the little joints in your spine are having to move. And the idea of the movement here is to help the upper thoracic, lower cervical part of our body, which is often a part that gets very kind of ossified and stiff as we get older. The movement is here to help that part of us free up a little bit. We do it regularly. These joints and stiff areas have to learn to move. But they will only free up, and this is the crucial bit, they will only free up if we're completely committed to the floor. If we're doing this with our ribs in the air or our head in the air, we're just making ourselves rigid. So we actually make ourselves stiffer. So the significant part of this is the commitment to the floor. That's what's significant. The movement is almost peripheral. We have to move in yoga, We have to make movements. But if we don't understand that the premise of the movement has to be predicated on grounding, you know, the commitment to the floor to undo tension, unnecessary activity in our muscles, then we often can practice and become stiffer rather than freer. Try it on the other side, see if it feels the same. Usually, like most things, we have a bias to one side. So again, you know, one of the nice things about yoga is that capacity to test ourselves out from side to side and notice. And, you know, nearly all of us will have biases one way or another. And usually if you go from side to side fairly regularly on a regular basis, biases slowly dissolve or become less, the gap becomes less large between one side and the other. And that, of course, is what we're hoping, so that we aren't constrained by bias. But if we don't understand that the unconscious tensions that we bring to movement, the unconscious behaviors that we have, are what gets in the way of life, then we can go through life exercising in ways that just reinforce our biases. If we had longer, we could discuss how we do that in thinking and our emotional patterns, because they all have the potential to solidify our biases into ossified behavior. So do one more of these. And then come back over into child. And even in child, which is a movement that most of us do very regularly, committing your head to the floor, really making sure that you're doing that, committing your elbows, your body weight to your thighs. I'm often surprised to notice that I haven't quite given the forehead to the floor or a cushion or a blanket, whatever you're using. I sit in bed sometimes, you know, I'm lying in bed just before I go off to sleep, I realize actually I'm not fully committed to the mattress. And then you're holding a little bit of tension, or you're sitting in a chair and your legs aren't really resting on the floor. We can come in sitting now. It's that interrogation, that learning how to interrogate our nervous system and say, what am I feeling? Do I notice it? Can I make an adjustment to make myself more comfortable? For me, yoga is that process of reinterrogating ourselves on a regular basis to get clearer and clearer about what I notice about myself. I'm aware time is whizzing by. Are there any questions, man, that we need to go through now?
Yes. So we have a question by Ananda. Can we truly move without any history? Part of the history to tell us what we need to do is move. So it's not necessarily negative or positive.
That's a very good point. Maybe I haven't clarified myself enough on that. Of course, all habits, you know, walking down the road is history. I've learned how to walk, so that's part of history. So what I'm interested in is the unconscious history that we bring, that we don't notice. So there's a nice quote, and I think it's in, it's called The Guru Papers, Joel Kramer's book, and Diane Allstadt's book. There's a quote in there, he says, if only I could stop doing the things that interfere with life. It's a quote that really landed in me, that the habits of behavior, it might be psychological behavior, the kind of angry response I have to somebody, or the tension that I get when I'm driving or having an argument with someone, those feelings that I don't notice but actually make me uncomfortable. I want to get better at spotting those things and learning how to respond in a way that wouldn't make me feel so uncomfortable. So what is it? You know, discomfort for me is the sensation to tell me that I'm not navigating the world as well as I might be able to. So it's a way of flagging up that there is something going on that you need to address. Now, whether you can address it or not depends on the circumstance, of course. But we have a nervous system that would move into what we call nociception in terms of the body. Not proprioception, information, but nociception, warning, something you're doing here might damage you. And in terms of emotions, uncomfortable feelings, those knots in the stomach, those lumps in your throat, those feelings, this is a Damasio's view, are there to help us navigate our social interactions with people. If I had a row with someone and I walk away with a knot in my stomach, did I navigate that conversation well or not? You know, why do I feel like this? Maybe I should go back and apologize, or at least put it on the table again. So I don't think we got that quite right. Or I've done something and my shoulder hurts afterwards. Did I navigate that movement as well as I should have? Did I bring something to it? Part of my history, usually. So that's what I'm kind of interested in. How do we use our feelings, our qualia, to help us notice how I've navigated the world? Can I do it better? For me, this is part of the whole practice of yoga, both psychologically and physically. I can see a few questions, there are boxes coming up.
So there is one by Pema, which is, how do we work with these principles of movement when pain is present?
Yeah, well, I had a whole day on this, so it's hard to do a couple of minutes, but here's something to think about anyway. Everybody hurts themselves from time to time. So you injure yourself, you pull a muscle, you tear a ligament. A couple of years ago, I lifted a piano and really hurt my back. I mean, very badly. And so you get damage to your tissues and you get pain, and the pain is there to make you be a bit more careful about your movement. And then the body starts to heal, because all bodies heal all the time. It's really important to remember that, unless we're talking about autoimmune diseases. I'm not right now. I'm talking about in a healthy human being, you injure yourself, bodies heal and pain subsides. That's the whole process of healing. If you cut yourself, it heals, pain subsides. The difficulty happens when the body heals and pain goes away. These are complex questions, but the current thinking is that what's happened here is a problem of perception, not sensation. The body is healed. The sensations that we're getting from our body are now being misread by the brain, and perception is telling us there's pain when there isn't, or when there's nothing wrong with the body. There is pain. I mean, that's clear. You can put people in a brain scanner, you can see they're in pain, but you can also put them in an MRI scanner and see there's nothing wrong with their tissues. So we need to change our attention to think, even if someone is going, oh, my back is hurting, you know, and I've got terrible pain in my back, the problem actually isn't in the tissues of the back, it's in the perception of the history of what they believe is going on in their back. So we have to deal with perception. And that's a longer conversation, but often what happens is we spend years trying to find the person to fix your tissues, when actually you should be looking for the person to help you with how you're perceiving the problems that you're feeling. Anything else?
If anyone has any other questions? Peter, you still have still have some time. So if you'd like to do anything else while another question comes in, or even if you'd like to reference any of the resources you mentioned, I think.
Well, we could do this while I do that. I'm happy to answer questions while we're doing something like this. So we sit with our feet in front of us and take our hands behind us. This is about patterns of movement. You know, if we shift our feet to one side, it's a bit like we did right at the beginning, and then bring our arms forwards and move our feet from side to side like this. The movement we would call a map, all movements are learned through maps we create in our sensory motor cortex. If you haven't got the map, you can't make the movement. So one of the problems about modern life is that in a sedentary world where we sit in cars and offices and armchairs, we don't make the kind of movements our body was evolved for. So we often have a sparse map of movements. Simple movements like this, which demand side bending my spine. If I go back, I've got flexion in my spine, I've got internal and external rotation in my hips. These rather simple but complicated maps of movement are very useful things to practice. They're not about stretching, they're not about strength, and they're not about stamina, but they are about creating complex maps of how we can be and refining movements like this. And this is one of many that we could do, is part of the process. Now, you have to be careful, or I think we have to be careful that you can't, you've got to be watching that you're trying to improve a movement. And how do we know our maps are getting better, which is what we want, is that the feeling of the movement becomes freer, easier. I could slow it down more, so I could get to a point now, how slowly could I make this movement? Is the map clear all the way through? Are there any parts I'm kind of stumbling through? So we're constantly getting feedback from our body and trying to make the map more skillful, so that in life we can transfer the kind of map reading skill into everyday behaviors, which is obviously what we're trying to do. We want to have a rich map of our body that enables us to navigate the world without being encumbered by a body that's hurting or struggling to move well.
One or two more questions, Pete.
Okay.
So one was just to clarify the book title for the Joel Kramer book.
Oh, yeah. It's called Guru Papers. It's a bit of a, you may or may not like the book. It was a fairly influential book for me at one point in my life. It's about the way unconscious power dynamics develop in spiritual teaching. And it's a bit of a polemic against some behaviors in the spiritual world where that kind of top-down teaching from can get unconsciously, well, yeah, abusive is a funny word in the modern term, because it's a very current term. He's not, I don't think, painting it quite in the terms we might use it in the very modern idiom. But how it goes awry, I think that's what he's interested in how what looks calm on the outside is often, there's something often going on, these hidden dynamics, these hidden behaviours. I found it a very useful book to read. So The Guru Papers by Diane Allstadt and Joel Kramer.
We have three, which probably you'll have to give a very concise answer to. So one is, with where you're at now, how much are you attached to calling it yoga?
That's a good question. If I was being really frank about it, I would probably call it humanistic, even Western yoga. That's a very long conversation. Why I would be interested in that. But very briefly, I've never felt very comfortable with the idea of trying to understand the cultural conditions in which yoga evolved, because I'm not in it. And it was years ago. I don't feel it in the way I think in the setting that it arose in. But I do think that the practices of introspection, of paying attention to sensation, to noticing how you engage with the world, that these are just very human aspects of behavior that yogis, I think, have been interested in. It's just we're shifting the cultural setting to being in the West. So I am interested in the practice, in the setting of the here and now. So I do think it's yoga, but it's kind of obviously a bit different. It's a bit like when Buddhism moved to Japan and it became Zen Buddhism. It shifted its kind of a way of working a bit because of the setting in which it was in. But that is a longer conversation. I may have not done myself justice there.
Yes, I appreciate that. That is not a quick question to answer. These two maybe will. So do you have any connection with Alexander technique? And second one is, what's the best way to start and engage with yoga?
Do I have any connection with Alexander technique? Well, I used to teach anatomy at an Alexander school, a friend of mine who ran an Alexander school in Brighton. And we had lots of conversations around the theme. And there are clearly some parallels, both with Alexander and with Feldenkrais. I think they're both two systems, Western systems, that have been approaching how we notice ourselves and how we notice attention. So I think there should be actually an overlap between all these systems, because we're dealing with human beings. If they were radically different, you'd think, well, are we really dealing with the same kind of organism? So I'm always relieved if I'm having a conversation with a practitioner of another system and I find lots of overlapping things. I think, we're probably all circulating the same kind of things. How do we start? I think the best thing to do is try a few classes with different teachers and find ones where you feel you resonate with what they're saying. I think that the teacher needs to be someone who you feel on the same page with. So don't try a teacher and then think, oh, I didn't like yoga because I didn't get on with that teacher. Teaching yoga is such a broad spectrum. You can find a mass of different approaches, which is part of its charm, really. Part of the nice thing about yoga is we can travel through all different types of yoga and find one that really works for us.
Great. We have to wrap up now. So thank you so much to Peter Blackaby for this session. I really appreciated it, just as a practitioner. And I'm sure for anyone that was here this morning, there's so much subtlety in the practice that we can take away from this session. Final announcement. So next sessions, the next two sessions we have coming up on the Yoga Channel. We have a Yoga Nidra session by Amanda Brown coming up in 2 hours. And then in 4 hours, so at noon in UK time, is Eddie Stern for Yoga for Higher Consciousness. And during the meantime, feel free to connect and have in the coffee break feature on the portal, so you can connect with other participants. Feel free to check in on the Facebook group and start some conversations there. And finally, if you'd like to own the library, so in order to have this free to stream model, if you'd like to own the recording package and digest it in your own time, then we really appreciate it. And Bears will post a link in the chat so that you can do that. If you'd like to learn more about Peter and what Peter is offering, Peter's website, Bears will also post in the chat as well, peterblackaby.co.uk.
Actually, can I change that?
Yeah, sure.
The website that's probably more usable at the moment is www.intelligentyoga.co.uk. That's where you'll find most of my stuff these days. I'm shifting websites.
That's okay. So that's intelligentyoga.co.uk. And even though I don't have the most current version of the book, I have the first version, and it is very, very good to staple on my shelf. So thank you so much, Pete.
Thank you.
We have one last tip. So your top tip on how to be more embodied.
Slow down. Simple. Slow down.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Thank you all for joining. And we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Thank you. Lovely being here.